From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, filling in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, Breaking Apart, we talk with writer Wendy Swallow about her new memoir of divorce. After 12 years, she and her husband ended their marriage. She found that the conventional wisdom about divorce was not only outdated, but just plain wrong. Also, we remember punk rocker Joey Ramone of the Ramones. He died Sunday at the age of 49. He had lymphoma. We'll listen back to his 1988 interview. And TV critic David Bianculli reviews last night's premiere of The Weakest Link, the latest British TV game show import. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Israel has withdrawn troops from the Gaza Strip less than 24 hours after invading one town there. It was the first time Israeli soldiers reoccupied land ceded to the Palestinians during the Oslo peace process. NPR's Jennifer Ludden explains what led to the withdrawal.
Essentially, the reinvasion of this tiny northeast corner of the Gaza Strip brought a chorus of criticism from the international community. Obviously, Arab states were very harsh. And the U.S. State Department also issued a rare rebuke. It did say that the Palestinian mortar attacks that led up to the move were provocative, but it called Israel's response excessive and disproportionate, and essentially publicly called on Israel to pull out very shortly after the government announced that it would do so.
NPR's Jennifer Ludden reporting from Gaza. The Bush administration says it will implement new regulations designed to keep better track of lead that's released into the environment. The rules will require companies to report to the EPA if they release more than 100 pounds of lead in a year. Industry groups say the regulations will just result in needless paperwork for thousands of small businesses. EPA Administrator Christy Whitman says the rules reflect President Bush's commitment to protecting children from lead poisoning. U.S. negotiators have arrived in Beijing for talks aimed at winning the return of an EP-3 reconnaissance plane that collided with a Chinese fighter jet. NPR's Rob Gifford reports from Beijing.
The leader of the 8-member U.S. delegation, Deputy Undersecretary of Defense Peter Verger, said on his arrival in Beijing that he expected the tone of tomorrow's talks to be frank. He would not comment on the U.S.'s agenda for the discussions. A Chinese foreign ministry spokeswoman today reiterated Beijing's position ahead of the talks. She said that U.S. reconnaissance activities near Chinese territory are the root cause of the incident and that China wants them stopped. But the Bush administration has already rejected that demand, saying the U.S. has the right to fly in international airspace. The spokeswoman also said Beijing wants to discuss the cause of the collision, on which the two sides strongly disagree. It's also expected they'll discuss whether China will return the $80 million U.S. reconnaissance plane. Rob Gifford, NPR News, Beijing.
President Bush said today that he'll press for the establishment of a hemisphere-wide free trade zone at this week's Summit of the Americas in Canada. The idea is opposed by unions and environmental groups, which say that such an agreement would put the United States at a disadvantage in competition with countries that have much weaker labor and environmental laws. In stocks today, the Dow gained 58 points to close at 10,216 in active trading. The Nasdaq gained 13 points to close at 1923. This is NPR News. Mississippi voters are choosing a state flag today. The current flag bears a Confederate emblem in the upper left-hand corner. The proposed flag replaces that emblem with a circle of stars. Melanie Peoples reports from Jackson, Mississippi.
Voters and not lawmakers are deciding the flag issue today in Mississippi. Last year, South Carolina lawmakers voted to remove the Confederate battle flag from their capital, and earlier this year, legislators in Georgia minimized the Confederate emblem on their state flag, putting it into a historical context. Mississippi lawmakers decided to let the people make the decision after Confederate heritage groups vowed revenge in the next election if legislators followed Georgia and South Carolina. Unlike Georgia and South Carolina, which put the Confederate battle flag on their state houses during integration in the 50s, Mississippi's flag has included the emblem since 1894. Supporters of the old flag see it as a tie to Mississippi's heritage, while new flag proponents say the old banner is forever tainted by racism. For NPR News, I'm Melanie Peoples in Jackson, Mississippi.
Firefighters in central Florida are worried that a change in the weather could make it harder to deal with wildfires. A cool front is expected to bring gusty winds and drier conditions in an area that's already experiencing a severe drought. Officials ordered the evacuation of about 40 houses last night in Osceola County, southeast of Orlando. The landowners were allowed to return today. Heavy smoke from another fire west of Orlando forced the closure of a 3-mile section of Interstate 4. Officials blame the smoke for contributing to 5 highway crashes. In stocks today, the broad-based S&P 500 gained 12 points to close at 1191. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, bringing Novasoy brand isoflavones to consumers throughout the United States. On the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, sitting in for Terry Gross. A few years ago, Wendy Swallow was a staff writer for The Washington Post when she decided to make her own life the subject of her journalism. The result is her new memoir, Breaking Apart, about her divorce and the difficulties she and her ex faced in their attempt to share custody of their 2 young sons. Swallow and her ex-husband have been separated for almost 9 years. They were married for 12. When she left her home and went about putting her new life together, Wendy Swallow found that much of the conventional wisdom she had heard about divorce just wasn't true. She wrote an article about it for The Washingtonian Magazine. An editor read the article and encouraged her to explore it further for a book. Terry spoke with Wendy Swallow recently. Let's begin with the reading from Breaking Apart.
There are many simple ways to explain why my marriage didn't work, and over the years I've probably used all of them. I was too young and he was too old. He was intense and spontaneous, where I was calm and controlled. His family life was so badly managed he left home at 16. I came from a family whose wisdom and love extended their influence over me well into my 30s. He was private and solitary. I wanted a life dense with family and friends. He was brilliant, I was not. He was depressed, I was not. He had fought for all the advantages in his life, I had not. I was lucky, he was not. When we met, he was 34, a brooding, bearded intellectual who had just returned from living and teaching in Europe for 4 years. I was 24, just 2 years out of college and still trying to figure out who and what I was going to be. Ron seemed infinitely worldly and interesting, the angry young man who was angry for all the right reasons. I was just his type, young, pliable, happy, stable, the perfect young protege, the attractive student at his knee. We quickly discovered that we shared many interests, literature, politics, drama, and music, and a foundation of common values. To the outside world, we seemed to fit together like hand and glove, and we did fit together. But over the years, I found that some of that fit came from long simmering conflicts inside us rather than healthy needs.
And that's Wendy Swallow reading from her new memoir about divorce, Breaking Apart. You had been thinking about divorce for years before you decided to actually ask for one. Was there a last straw or a moment that made you said decisively, I'm going through with it?
There were several stages. I mean, I had gone to my ex-husband earlier, about a year and a half before we actually split up, and said, you know, I really think that this is not working at all, and I need to get out. And or at that point, I think I said, let's get some counseling. And he was put off by the idea of counseling. I think he felt that it was a path to splitting up. I mean, I've discovered many men believe this, that, I mean, not all of them, but I've heard this from other men, that they were at first frightened of marital counseling because they thought it was, you know, sort of like getting the coffin out and examining it. So he refused at that point. About 6 months later, I came back to him and said, look, I'm going to call a lawyer if we don't go to counseling. And he said, okay. So we entered counseling. We spent about 9 months in counseling. The counseling was very useful because it really revealed for the first time, it sort of swept away the rubble of everyday life and revealed the real differences between us, the sort of permanent, difficult pieces that weren't probably going to change. And so it was in the process of that counseling that I finally came to a realization. In fact, at one point, the counselor turned to me and said, sort of privately, I think you know what you need to do. And I went home and I thought, oh my God, somebody just gave me permission. But it was helpful to really clarify what I was dealing with. So.
What were some of those differences that you felt would never change?
I think in some ways, my ex-husband didn't want to be married. And we had a fascinating conversation about 4 years after we split up, where we sat around one night on his porch and drank some brandy. And I said, you know, I used to feel like I was an annoyance in the house. Just by being in the house, I irritated you. And he said, yeah, actually, you did. He said, you know, but it wasn't you. He said, actually, you know, it would have been anybody. And I think in many ways he has, I think it's a challenge for him. He gets a lot of energy from people, but he also likes his privacy. He's very intellectual. He loves to read. He likes his quiet. I mean, there were many things that I did just by being another person in the house that annoyed him, but it made me feel as if I didn't have the right to live in my own house, which is not a very easy way to go through life, feeling that you know, can't call your mother on the phone because that will irritate someone. And I just think that we had very different living styles that made me feel as if I had to constantly pull in my wings and sort of tiptoe around. And that was difficult. He also struggled with depression. He struggled with his temper, and that was corrosive over time. It's hard to rebuild a marriage that's suffered a lot of that.
What kind of problems did his depression pose for you?
Well, it was mostly that his depression was laced with anxiety and...
Anger?
And anger. I began to see over time that the anger was rooted in anxiety, which made me more sympathetic to it, but I still didn't want to live with it. You know, I didn't blame him, but I still didn't want to be around it sometimes. And so... It meant things like we had to, you know, we didn't take as many risks as I thought we should. I mean, every now and then, every time I tried to make a job shift, he would counsel me, you know, not to do it, not to be too ambitious, that you're not ready for that yet. And I found over time that I just couldn't, you know, sort of confer with him on these things, that I needed to do what I felt I needed to do for my career. Even though it would make him nervous because he would be afraid I'd, you know, get fired or lose a job or something.
You were aware that there were serious problems in your marriage at the time that you decided to have children. And you say in your memoir that all your friends asked you why are you having children if there's problems in your marriage. So let me ask you, too. Why did you decide to go forward consciously with having children, knowing that there were such serious marital problems?
Well, the more serious marital problems really manifested more between the kids and then after our second was born. And I think when we had our first child, we were still, you know, he had only been in counseling for a couple of years. I think I was still very hopeful that counseling for him would make a really substantial difference, that he would change in a radical way. And you know, I believed that it would cure him on some level. Now, I think that was naivete. I didn't really know what to look forward to. And I also thought that medication might help. You know, that has helped to some degree. But, you know, he was in his 40s. And, you know, I think that when people are older, it's harder, you know, to have really... you know, a complete personality change at that age. But I was still very hopeful. I was still very optimistic. And I think that there's a part of the book where I talk about it's very difficult to live your entire life sort of on hold as if you might get divorced any minute. You really can't live that way. You continue with your life. I mean, in all kinds of couples I've seen, you know, they schedule a complete kitchen renovation and then in the middle of it get divorced. It's like, you know, you didn't know 2 months ago that you were on the verge of divorce. Well, it's hard to pick that point at which you stop trying. Because most couples, I think, try. They try desperately until it gets to the breaking point. And so you try almost everything. And I think in some ways, you know, we were ready to have kids. We both very much wanted children. I'd had one miscarriage. I was getting a little worried that I might not be able to have children if I waited too much longer. And I wasn't ready to get divorced at the point I had my first son. Then after I had him, I realized just the power shifted, the power relationship in our marriage shifted fairly considerably after I had my first child, because I began to sort of assert my own opinion and power much more in the relationship, and that made the relationship more difficult. And then when we had, and then we had a second fairly quickly, partly because it made sense for me career-wise to have them close together. That's ultimately proved to be a good thing. They're very close. But it, once we had the second child, then a lot of things escalated.
Wendy Swallow, speaking with Terry Gross. Swallow's new memoir about divorce is called Breaking Apart. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, we're featuring Terry Gross's interview with writer Wendy Swallow. Her new memoir of divorce is Breaking Apart.
You write that there was a period in your life when you started to imagine that the man who was your husband was dead. And it seemed like this was a way of not having to decide to divorce, that actually going through with a divorce seems so hard and so something that you really didn't want to go through with, that if he had just kind of died, it would have made it possible for you not to go through this terribly painful divorce. It's such a bizarre way of thinking, though.
It was, and that scared the daylights out of me, that I would think that. I've since discovered that a lot of divorced people went through a period of wishing that their spouse would die. It's just, you know, fate takes over. It's not your fault anymore. And I think that was part of it, was that I didn't want to be the bad girl. I'd always been a pretty good girl. I'd been, you know, I'd done everything everyone told me to do. And I, you know, I think on some level when you have children and you create a family, you sort of make this, you know, it's almost like this contract with society, and including my parents. I felt like I was failing everyone, that if I couldn't make my family work, then I had really screwed up and I was a failure as a person in ways that, you know, in much more substantive ways than I'd ever failed at anything before. I mean, it just didn't even come close to anything else before. And so it was much easier to fantasize about, oh, well, maybe some miracle will happen and he'll just drop dead one day. But then I would sit there and look at myself, what kind of person was this who would sit there and wish that? The irony, too, is I knew in my heart that it was not what my kids needed for their dad to die. And so that was a brief period. It was one of those moments when I realized that the divorce was making me, that the conflict around this divorce was making me into someone that I didn't want to be, and that, you know, I didn't like this person that was emerging, and that I needed to sort of get a handle on things and myself to be able to make sure I could live my life as someone I would be proud to be.
Were you ever surprised that it was you who was asking for the divorce? Because after all, one of the problems you had in your marriage was that the man who was your husband seemed to be irritated by your presence. He had such a need for privacy and for quiet so he could read, which you would, I'm sure, have interpreted as him having a problem with you, but it was you who was asking for the divorce. Were you surprised that it was you and not him?
Oh, yeah, a little bit. I think I, for years, thought he might divorce me. But then as, I think now that I look back on it, you know, he really, I think on some level he was willing to live with our lives the way they were more than I was. In that, I'm not sure he had a sort of paradigm of a happier place in his head. I'd had a quite happy childhood. My parents had a very happy, stable marriage, very supportive marriage. And I still wanted that. I had that in my mind as, you know, the thing that I couldn't manage to achieve somehow. And so I think ultimately, you know, it took an enormous amount of courage to actually do it. And not that he lacked that courage. I just think that he didn't think divorce would make things better. And so why tear it all apart and why hurt the kids that way?
When you told the man who was your husband that you wanted to divorce, did he promise to change?
Not at that point. He had promised to change earlier, and it had never really happened. There was a point in the first 6 months after our separation when we were fighting, is maybe too strong a word, but we were in conflict over the custody arrangement for the kids. And I said, you know, if you don't learn to manage your anger, it's really not, you know, you're going to lose these boys the way you lost me. And he got that. And he worked really hard after that on changing. And he did change. And it was interesting to see it happen. But he didn't do it for me. He did it for them.
What was it like when you decided to go ahead with your divorce? Things were moving forward, but you were still living together.
Well, that was the worst period. It was, I think of it as this demilitarized zone. You know, we, on some level, we were both, I think, relieved that we knew what was happening, but we hadn't told the kids yet. They were only 3 and 5, so, you know, you don't want to tell them, well, in 3 months, mommy's moving out. We hadn't settled the custody issue yet, and we weren't sure who was moving out. At first, he said he would move out, and he even put a deposit on an apartment and things like that, and then he was advised by his lawyer not to move out so that it wouldn't weaken his bid for joint custody. And so suddenly I realized nothing was moving. It was a very difficult period. And so then I mobilized and moved out myself.
What kind of custody arrangement did you work out?
We actually worked out a 50-50 split. And at first, the first year, we had a week on and a week off. The problem was that they were much too young, particularly the 3-year-old, to be able to cope with being away from the other parent for a whole week. And the worst moment was the first, when I moved out, I actually took the boys with me for that week. And the next week, though, when they went back to their dad's, I went up, I actually had the right to have, I guess I had them one night in the middle of the week. And so I went to his daycare center. I hadn't seen him since Sunday, and it was a Wednesday. And he came running up to the fence of the playground, and he looked at me and he goes, Mom, you came back. Well, I'd been telling this child nonstop that I would be back, I would see him on Wednesday, I showed him on the calendar, I did everything all the book said to do. And I was talking to a psychologist about this later, and I said, you know, it was as if he thought I'd gone to the moon. And she looked at me, and she goes, no, he didn't think you went to the moon, he thought you died. Well, the thought that my 3-year-old son spent several days thinking mommy had totally disappeared and probably died was so overwhelming. It was just awful. I think shortly thereafter, we decided to split the week so that the kids would only be away from each of us for about 3 days. And that was much better. We still do that, in fact.
What was it like for the kids to have to switch homes every couple of days?
Well, a lot of people will tell you that that's very damaging. And I think the problem, you know, the reason why custody is such a painful, difficult issue is that there's no good solution to it. And once a couple splits, there's no good solution. So you look at, you know, what does the least damage? I truly believe now, from having watched my own children, that losing significant time with either parent is damaging, is truly damaging. But moving back and forth between houses it's logistically a bit of a headache, but that's something that kids adapt to better than not having a relationship with one parent, or with either parent. So my kids have bounced back and forth fairly easily. When they were younger, we transferred a lot more stuff back and forth. Now that they're older, they don't need to bring the same stuffed animals, or, I mean, they're beyond stuffed animals now, but sometimes I almost feel like they're a little relieved, you know, like they get to leave mommy's house before she actually made them clean their bedroom up. You know, they get to sort of escape to dad's.
When you divorce and you have children, you still have to be partners in parenting. So you've said goodbye to your husband, he's now your ex-husband, but you still have a relationship through your children, and you still have to do planning together and working things out together. Is that difficult for you?
Well, it's very difficult at the beginning, and I think that many couples never get beyond that point. I mean, you know, to tear apart a marriage almost necessitates, you know, anger and bitterness. I mean, to actually make the break, it's very difficult. There are so many unconscious bonds in marriage that you really don't recognize until you start to unravel them. So, you know, many couples come out, you know, in this very embittered, angry place. And yet, if you're co-parenting, you really need to start to work together. And I think what we finally came to, we hired a psychologist who worked with us, and she was really great at identifying what, you know, what would work and what not to try. That we finally came to think of it as a business-like arrangement. I mean, we weren't adversaries in our goal to raise our children. I mean, the irony here is that it would be terrible if my ex-husband died. I mean, he's the only other person on the planet who cares about my children the way I do and will, you know, do anything for them and think of their needs first. And we came to recognize that that was a very powerful bond. And so, but it took translating that into little acts. And this is, I think, where it's both challenging but ultimately rewarding. I mean, every time I talk to a teacher about one of the kids, I'd either email him or call my ex-husband up and say, I just wanted to share this with you. This is what's happening in the kindergarten class. And there was, we had to really operate in a way that almost every societal model said wouldn't work, which was to continue to have, you know, daily conversations. And it was difficult at first, but in time it really started to pay off. And so I think we both fairly quickly came to recognize that, you know, we could make a huge difference in the way our kids experience this divorce by the way that we work together. And that was the single most important thing that we focused on for several years.
Wendy Swallow's new memoir is called Breaking Apart. We'll hear more of our conversation with Terry Gross in the second half of our show. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Holland America, offering cruises to destinations worldwide, including the Caribbean, the Panama Canal, Alaska, and Europe. On the web at hollandamerica.com. And from Wilmington Trust, a wealth management company providing investment and trust services to individuals, families, and corporations nationwide for nearly 100 years. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, the slow progress towards divorce. We continue our conversation with Wendy Swallow, author of a new memoir about the end of her marriage. Also, we remember punk rocker Joey Ramone, who died Sunday at the age of 49. And David Bianculli reviews last night's premiere of The Weakest Link.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, in for Terry Gross. Let's return now to Terry's interview with Wendy Swallow, a former staff writer for The Washington Post. Swallow has come out with a memoir of her divorce called Breaking Apart. She and her husband ended their marriage after 12 years. They've now been apart for 9.
I think your divorce took about 5 years to go through. Do I have that right?
Well, yes. I mean, we made quite a bit of progress in the first couple of years. And then some of that time, about a year and a half of it, in fact, was just slow legal machine. You know, it took months to get on the docket in D.C. And when we did, it turned out that the judge didn't think we were even legally married, so we had to go back and get the right marriage license, which was sort of strange, and then come back 3 months later. So about the last year and a half was we were pretty much ready. But some of that time was settling the financial piece, which was hard because we didn't have a lot. I mean, we had our pensions and we had a house. And that was pretty much it. So it was difficult to split that up. What finally worked for us was the mediators that we worked with through the D.C. Superior Court, who were just wonderful, really helped us see that our needs were different. Because he was 10 years older than I was, he was much more concerned about preserving his retirement funds, where I was more concerned about having money, you know, immediately. I mean, I was the poorest years of my life will turn out to be probably the 3 years after I separated. And so I was struggling with, you know, not being able to, you know, get the car fixed. And so we were able to, once we sort of recognized that our needs were different, we were able to sort of horse trade stuff back and forth in a kind of creative manner. And we finally, you know, came up with something that really, really had the goal of both of us coming out whole. I mean, we both wanted to be able to reinvest in real estate. We both wanted to be able to take vacations. And we both wanted, you know, to be stable in our jobs. And we made that a commitment. And our agreement was that we would honor and respect our career needs. And, you know, because we knew that having both of us work was an important piece of supporting the boys financially. So it wasn't motivated by, well, I'll make him pay for that or, you know, there was a lot of give and take, and ultimately that was easier because we both, I think, came to believe that it was really about supporting the kids. Neither one of us were going to spend a lot of money on ourselves, so that made it easier.
So you liked the experience of having mediators?
The mediators were terrific, yes. What worked was two mediators, in fact. We tried one mediator, and that didn't seem to work at all, but the two mediators we worked with, one was a former social worker and one was a former lawyer. They were both sort of somewhat retired, the lawyer in particular. But the nice thing was that one was male, one was female, and they were very good at helping us see possibilities we couldn't imagine. And they would listen to us each individually, listen to us together. They set ground rules for the discussion. So, you know, there was no swearing, there was no... And, you know, they would cut it off if somebody... you know, tripped over that line. And so I felt safe. I came to feel safe in that environment. I'd always thought that mediation wouldn't work for us because my ex-husband had studied, he was a political scientist, particularly his expertise was in labor union work. And so, you know, he was a pretty clever negotiator, basically. I mean, he understood a lot about negotiation that I did not. And so I always thought, oh, if we go to a mediator, I'll just end up with nothing. But the mediators had a fairness model in mind that they never let go of, and that helped protect me in the process. And I learned how to speak up and say, sorry, that's not fair, and that's not what the law says I'm entitled to. And, you know, I learned how to speak up for my rights better in the process.
You're about to get married. Can you tell us a little bit about the man you're marrying now? Or how you met him?
Well, the interesting thing was when I first wrote about... this book grew out of an article I wrote for Washingtonian Magazine, which was a first-person piece about divorce. And the man I'm going to marry called me up after the story ran. That's how I actually met him. And he and about, you know, 10 to 15 other single dads in the Washington area either wrote me or sent me letters, pictures of them and their kids. And I think there's a real hunger out there among single dads, to meet someone who I think understands what they've been through. I think that's part of what was attractive about me in the article. That we also have a joke between us that those personal ads in the back of Washingtonian that are, you know, only 30 words, that's just not long enough. You know, if you have 3,000 words, you can really make a case for yourself. But I had no idea that I was doing that when I wrote the article.
Well, you didn't think of yourself as doing that.
No, I didn't. But
well, I'm surprised
it worked.
I'm actually surprised you followed up and met one or more of the people who wrote you, because I mean, I think a lot of people would have the opposite reaction and not want to meet somebody who is asking them out on a date, basically. You know.
Well, of course,
through the mail,
none of them ever.
Yeah.
Yeah, but none of them made it sound like it was a date. I mean, the other thing, too, is there's some sort of solidarity among divorced people, particularly single parents. I mean, there's an instant sort of understanding that, you know, about a lot of things in your life. The other benefit was both he and I, the man I'm marrying, had worked at the Washington Post. And, in fact, we'd only missed each other by a couple of months. He came to work there shortly after I left. And so we had a lot of friends in common at the newspaper. And it was... he liked the same people that I liked and respected. And so I knew from that first conversation that he had to be a pretty good guy if these people were close to him. And in fact, before I actually met him for lunch, I called several of them and they said, oh, he's a wonderful man, wonderful man. So I thought, it was funny at the time, I thought, the irony was I had just bought my house. Literally, I'd been in the house 3 days and I needed to go to Home Depot because I didn't have any mini blinds or anything on the windows. And I had sworn to my realtor when I bought the house that I would not move until the kids were done with high school, because she thought I had paid a little bit too much for it. I said, nope, I'm not going anywhere. This is it. I've given up. You know, I'd been out of my marriage for about 6-7 years. And 3 days after I move in, he calls. And within a month or two, we knew we would probably get married. But that was several years ago. We've taken it slow.
So are you selling your house now?
Yes, now I'm selling my house. But the market's gone up, so it's okay.
Well, I wish you very good luck in your new marriage.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, it was a pleasure, Terry. Thank you.
Wendy Swallow is the author of Breaking Apart, A Memoir of Divorce. A new collection of poems and lyrics by Paul McCartney will be published next week. It's called Blackbird Singing. Terry Gross recently recorded an interview with McCartney, which will air soon. Many of the poems were inspired by McCartney's late wife, Linda McCartney, and by the late Ivan Vaughan, a schoolboy friend who introduced Paul McCartney to John Lennon. One lyric featured in the collection is for McCartney's song Blackbird from the Beatles' White Album.
Blackbird singing in the dead of night. Take these broken wings and learn to fly. All your life you were only waiting for this moment to arise. Blackbird singing in the dead of night. Take these sunken eyes and learn to see. All your life you are only waiting for this moment to be free. Blackbird, fly. Blackbird, fly. Into the line of a dark black night. All your life, you were only waiting for this moment to arise. You were only waiting for this moment to arise. You were only waiting for this moment to arise.
Blackbird Singing, Paul McCartney's collection of poems and lyrics, comes out next week. Terry Gross will speak with McCartney on an upcoming edition of Fresh Air. Coming up, you are the weakest link. Goodbye. This is Fresh Air. Network television's eagerness to try almost anything when it comes to quiz and reality shows continues in full force this week. Last night, NBC premiered the quiz show The Weakest Link. Another episode airs tonight. Also tonight, UPN unveils Chains of Love, a so-called reality show about four people chained to one person of the opposite sex. TV critic David Bianculli has this review.
It's easy to identify the missing link between Chains of Love, the awful new series from UPN, and The Weakest Link, the delightful new series from NBC. For both of them, we can thank ABC and Who Wants to Be a Millionaire. When that show hit two summers ago, it changed all the rules of primetime TV. CBS, the following summer, tried Survivor, and the rules changed even more. Networks tried, and mostly failed, to come up with another popular quiz show. Instead, we got junk like the Fox series Greed. And networks tried, and mostly succeeded, to come up with other popular reality shows. So we got junk like the Fox series Temptation Island and Boot Camp. ABC thought it had the next big quiz show in Mastermind, which, like Millionaire, was based on a British game show from the same production company. The problem with Mastermind, and the reason ABC ultimately passed on it, was that the show and its contestants were too smart. Forget about viewers at home playing along by knowing the answers. It was tough enough just trying to understand the questions. The Weakest Link, on the other hand, is a perfect melding of the not-too-tough questions of Millionaire and the tribe-has-spoken rejection process of Survivor. The game starts with eight contestants, all of whom try to pool prize money into an ever-growing pot by answering questions correctly. After each lightning-fast round of questions, the participants get to vote someone out of the game until the last two players compete in a winner-take-all final round. The game is ruthless. Just like its host, Anne Robinson, whom NBC wisely imported straight from the original British version.
Marcus, Bank. What is the two-word motto for the Boy Scouts of America?
Always faithful.
Be prepared. Kira, which Nobel Prize winner did Time magazine name Person of the Century?
Nelson Mandela.
Albert Einstein. Karen. Which delivery company is famous for the slogan when it absolutely, positively has to be there overnight?
FedEx.
Correct, John. Which O is the Japanese art of decorative paper folding?
Origami.
Correct, René. In science, which 15th century Polish astronomer was the first to suggest that Earth orbits the sun?
Galileo.
Time is up. The correct answer is Copernicus. And out of a possible $125,000, team, in that round, you banked a miserable, depressing, pathetic $7,500. That money will, however, go through to the next round, but one of you will not. Who is keeping you out of the upper tax bracket? One of you is about to leave with nothing. It's time to vote off The Weakest Link.
The Weakest Link, like Millionaire, is instantly addictive. Just fast enough, just smart enough, just mean enough. NBC, far behind in the quiz and reality genre, finally has a winner and knows it, which is why The Weakest Link is being sprinkled across the primetime schedule all this week. NBC also knows a loser when it sees one. Which is why, after starting to develop Chains of Love, it dropped the show like a cold potato. The premise has one person chained to four people of the opposite sex set up for the duration in a special apartment, and given the power to reject one of them at regular intervals until only one contestant is left. It's supposed to be a combination of the real world, Survivor, and the Defiant Ones. But what it is horrendous. But when NBC dumped the concept as too tacky, UPN, the home of WWF SmackDown, was ready and eager to lap up the table scraps. The attitude at UPN had to be, too tasteless and low rent for NBC? Where do we sign? And watch out, because here it comes.
A distant bell summons the group into the ritual room where the chaining ceremony will begin.
Great. In a few minutes, you are all going to be chained together, and you will stay that way 24 hours a day for several days. Andy, there are going to be certain times when you must choose which of these women you want to release from the chain. You will know when those times come when you meet the locksmith. The locksmith carries a key to your chains and $10,000 cash. Andy, when you release each woman, you must decide how much of that money you feel that woman deserves. Now, can you all please stand? Andy, on your way over here, you opened up...
That's enough of that. It'd be accurate to call Chains of Love the worst reality show to emerge since the arrival of Millionaire and Survivor, but that's being a little premature and optimistic. There are so many more of these shows in development that I'm afraid we ain't seen nothing yet.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News.
Chain, chain, chain. Chain, chain.
Aretha Franklin, recorded in 1967. Coming up, we remember Joey Ramone. This is Fresh Air.
Hurry, 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 before I go to sleep. I can't control my fingers.
Joey Ramone, founder and lead singer for the pioneer punk rock band The Ramones, died Sunday at the age of 49 of lymphatic cancer. He had battled the disease for 6 years. In 22 years performing together, the Ramones influenced such British groups as the Sex Pistols, The Clash, later Nirvana, and U2. As a drummer turned frontman, Joey Ramone was the central personality of the band. Gangly and hawk-nosed, with his raw voice, black leather, and massive frizzy dark hair, he made ungainliness irresistibly hip. After the Ramones disbanded in 1996, Joey Ramone continued to perform occasionally with his brother, Mickey Lee, and others. Terry spoke with him in 1988 about his years with the Ramones.
The band sounded really radical and alien, different when it started. But I would think that in a lot of ways, you really saw yourself when you started as being more related to the roots of rock and roll than a lot of the quote, progressive rock of the time.
Yeah, well, that's what we're reacting against. Rock and roll wasn't rock and roll anymore. I mean, it was fused with all kinds of things. I mean, albums became six cuts. You know, like, you wouldn't hear songs anymore. They were non-existent. They were, like, all kinds of jams and guitar solos and total cliche pretentiousness. I mean, it was... rock and roll was always simple and exciting and pure and from the guts. And if you listen to Buddy Holly or Elvis Presley or the Beatles or the Stones or the Who, I mean, that was exciting music. That was exciting rock and roll music. I mean, what happened to it? It just didn't. It was a void. You know what I mean?
So you were playing really short songs under 3 minutes.
Well, with the songs we grew up on that was rock and roll music were 3 minute songs. You know, I mean, whether it be the Beatles or the Stones or the Kinks or the Who or the American bands, Phil Spector, songs were meant to be short. You know, they weren't supposed to go on for hours,
I don't want to be a beanhead no more. I just met a nurse that I could go for. I don't want to be a beanhead no more. I just met a nurse that I could go for.
A lot of your songs were basically 2, 3, or 4 chords with a real thrashing rhythm, and I was wondering if the musicians in the band just played a few chords because that's all they could play, or it's because they all or was it all they wanted to play?
Well,
or does it not matter to you?
No, because see, you're wrong there. I mean, yeah, a lot of the songs were like 3 or 4 chords, but then if you listen to Buddy Holly or Elvis Presley or Little Richard, those songs are 3 chords too. You know what I mean? So
yeah.
I don't understand what people are saying. You know, I mean, that rock and roll was always simplistic, and that's where the intensity is. I mean, that it's like short and simple and exciting and spontaneous. That's what rock and roll is, spontaneity.
You started out playing at CBGB's, the club in New York that became known as the center of the punk scene in the mid-70s. What were the initial reactions the Ramones got when they first started to play there?
Well, our first audience there were Hildy Crystal, who's the proprietor, the bartender and his dog. Those were the first people who came to see us, because CBGB's was a slum bar that nobody would come to, and they came to much later, And it was like word of mouth in the beginning, And then we got the Warhol crowd, because the gays were always first to pick up on things.
When the word punk was coined to describe the kind of music you and other bands were playing, what did you think of the word of punk rock?
Well, we got tagged punk rock. We always considered ourselves rock and roll, And to me, like, my feelings about the term punk is like an attitude. And, like, some people are punks and some people aren't, And it's really a state of being, the term punk. I mean, Elvis Presley was a punk. Jim Morrison was a punk. Iggy Pop is a punk, Mick Jagger. So if you're gonna call us punk, I mean, no, I'm not gonna mind. I mean, I think John F. Kennedy was a punk,
When you first started singing songs like Teenage Lobotomy, I think you were no longer a teenager. Probably in your early 20s when that came out. And I guess I was curious about singing and writing so many songs with teenage-type lyrics, yet not really being in your teens any longer.
Well, it's all state of mind, isn't it? I don't get old. I decided I wasn't going to get old, and I'm still the same.
As you pointed out, when the Ramones started to play, the music sounded really radical. Well, how does it sound now? Do you think it still sounds alien? Does it sound different? Does it sound more pop than it used to?
No, it's more radical now than it ever was before. But now, but there's other forms of music now that didn't exist then, like speed metal and thrash metal. So, like the Ramones, we like songs, we're song oriented, and bands like Anthrax, Metallica, and Megadeth, and you know whoever.
Do you like their music?
Yeah, I think they're great. I mean, I really like them because I like their attitude.
Joey Ramone, from a 1988 interview. He died Sunday at the age of 49. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. Our researcher is Jessica Chu. For Terry Gross, I'm Barbara Bogave.
Well, the kids are all hopped up and ready to go. They're ready to go now. They got that circle and they're going to the discotheque.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Nonesuch Records and soprano Dawn Upshaw's release, Angels Hide Their Faces, featuring music of Bach and Purcell, available at Barnes & Noble Music locations. And from Random House Incorporated's Delta Trade Paperback Division, publisher of Tulip Fever by Deborah Moga, a novel about the tulipomania set in 17th century Amsterdam. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, a story of tribulation and martyrdom, the struggle to interpret the Bible into English, culminating with the most famous King James Version. We talk with historian Benson Bobrick. His new book is Wide as the Waters. Join us for the next Fresh Air.